Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's the start of a new week, and a week of big headlines it promises to be, beginning with the successful special forces raid on the compound of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and his subsequent death. Congressional Democrats and Republicans are also preparing for more hearings in the impeachment inquiry. Popular protests continue around the world, and we will always have Brexit. So this hour on Point, what to look for in the week ahead. And you can join us. What did you make of the president's press conference announcing the death of the ISIS leader? Does the major setback for ISIS do anything to weaken the group's underlying ideology? And what about in that impeachment inquiry? Are you expecting some bombshells from hearings like we had last week? Do you see a united or divided GOP on impeachment? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we've got a great panel with us today to help us look ahead to the week's news. Lisa Desjardins covers news from the U.S. Capitol for PBS NewsHour. She's with us from Arlington, Virginia. Lisa, it's great to have you back.
Hi, great to be here.
Natasha Bertrand is national security correspondent for Politico. She joins us from Washington. Natasha, good to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us from Washington is Michelle Kaczynski. For years, she served as foreign correspondent for CNN, most recently as senior diplomatic correspondent. Michelle, it's good to talk with you.
Hi, happy Monday.
Well, first of all, so let's start straight off with that special forces raid and the killing of al-Baghdadi. First of all, let's listen to a little bit from the president's press conference yesterday when he announced the death.
He died like a dog. He died like a coward. He was whimpering, screaming, and crying. And frankly, I think it's something that should be brought out so that his followers and all of these young kids that want to leave various countries, including the United States, they should see how he died. He didn't die a hero. He died a coward.
Michelle, I'll start with you. This is a major success for U.S. Special Forces here.
Yes, very dramatic.
Yeah, what impact is it going to have?
That's the question, of course, because in the near term, the infighting that's possible among the remaining members of ISIS for who's going to be in charge could be destabilizing to the group. And, you know, you could say what remains of the group, really, because there are some signs that they are resurging or they're taking refuge in other areas. The ideology, as you mentioned, going into this segment won't necessarily change. In fact, there could be more attacks within coming days and weeks as a sort of retaliation for this very high-profile killing. So some things will not change and may even become stronger in the ideological sense. But in the organizational sense, this could have some impact. Of course, the way the president described it in his press conference was classic President Trump, focusing on grisly details, repeating things over and over, thanking Russia and Syria, and of course, you know, all the while not notifying high-ranking Democratic members of Congress before this happened, as you would expect would be the case. So he gave warning to Republicans, but not Democrats. And to listen to him describe it, of course, this was the greatest takedown in all of history.
Well, to the point you just made, Michelle, let's listen to what the president did say about who he informed about this raid and when.
They hate ISIS as much as we do. You know what ISIS has done to Russia. So, no, we did not tell. They did not know the mission, but they knew we were going over an area that they had a lot of firepower.
And have you notified the congressional leaders about this? Pelosi?
We've notified some. Others are being notified now as I speak. We were going to notify them last night, but we decided not to do that because Washington leaks like I've never seen before.
Natasha, your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, typical Trump. I think that it's not necessarily surprising that he would choose not to notify top Democrats because, you know, he is very bitter about the fact that there is an impeachment inquiry going on. And Nancy Pelosi, of course, is one of his chief rivals. But at the same time, it is pretty unprecedented for a raid of this magnitude and an operation of this magnitude to not be on the House Intel Committee's radar, at least the chairman of the House Intel Committee, Adam Schiff. So there's been a lot of consternation among Democrats about that. But I also think, you know, this is just more par for the course for the president. I mean, he is a very obviously partisan figure. And with regard to how he, you know, chooses to frame this as a major victory for his administration, then it was to be expected that he was only going to tell his close friends within Congress. Another thing, obviously, is that he doesn't tend to listen to his advisors. So in terms of whether or not he was supposed to keep this completely under wraps, whether he was allowed or, you know, whether he was advised to tell certain members of Congress and not others, that was likely always going to be something he did of his own volition. Mm.
Now, Lisa Desjardins, I mean, you cover Congress, and I'm going to get to sort of the concern about who he informed on Capitol Hill and when. But a lot of people have been picking on this notion that the president informed Russia first before before members of Congress. But to be fair, I mean, as the president said, this operation happened in an area, according to the president, where the Russians had a lot of firepower. I mean, it doesn't seem out of the ordinary, per se, to coordinate, not necessarily coordinate, but inform other forces, other nations who are operating the area so that they don't bomb our soldiers.
I think that's a worthy point. I think this area of the world is a tinderbox, as you're hearing from everyone on this show. And as we are seeing right now, the president is making some momentous decisions that will affect this area of the world for generations and how the United States is seen in that area of the world for generations. Mm-hmm. And I think something that got my attention in his remarks was, of course, he thanked the Russians, the Turks, the Syrians, because we needed to fly over, or we needed their support generally, or kind of approval to get to this area. But he also mentioned the Syrian Kurds and said that they had some specific help they gave. The New York Times is reporting that actually the Syrian Kurds, that their intelligence was really the most critical in tracking down Baghdadi. Now, at the same time, you know, one thing on my mind, honestly, is that, you know, are we looking at this raid differently because it's this president? And I know this isn't a debate about the media, but I think that it is worth talking about what a success this was, that while we have to look at the larger dynamics in that region and ISIS as it exists now, that I worry that sort of this automatic, let's talk about all the criticism, let's talk about what he said, let's talk about him using classic Trump rhetoric, misses the point that this was a huge success for American forces to have pulled this off so far into a very difficult territory, to have lost no personnel, except there was a trained canine that died in this, is really extraordinary. And I think we'll know more as the days come, but analyzing how our forces did this is also well worth it. And the president made this call even as we were pulling out of the area. That's something we're going to hear more about. But this was President Trump's call, and it was a successful operation.
Right. Point taken. And I would actually agree with you that we should always scrutinize ourselves as a media in terms of how we're talking about these major events here. But Michelle, to what Lisa just said, should we talk a little bit more about the timing? Because this did happen in the, you know, on the heels of the president also deciding to pull out of this exact region.
Well, there is no reason not to talk about all of it. I mean, we don't have an endless amount of time. But of course, it's striking that it was successful, how it was able to be done. And we know from sources that there were a couple of attempts made to plan this prior, but they didn't work out because of Baghdadi's own movements. But there's also some evidence, this is coming from sources within the Department of Defense, that this happened more in spite of Trump's recent decision-making on Syria than because of it. That it's not necessarily that this was rushed because of the American pullout, but it needed to be done before the U.S. lost key intelligence sources from Kurds and key positions and the ability to move with air cover and other protections that are necessary because of the president's decision making, which is criticized by members of his own party. So there are Republicans that are angry about the way the president has moved recently in Syria. So a very successful and important operation. And I think you really get a sense of that when you hear from family members of victims of al-Baghdadi. And you see how much this means to the people who are most affected
right.
by the horror of ISIS. But it's the president himself who's injecting a level of partisanship, as he almost always does, just in the way he presents this. So you need to, if you're going to focus only on the success of it, you need to ignore a lot of the decision-making of the president himself, and you need to sort of gloss over the way that he presents what happened. So when you enclose all of it in there, you can't separate out, you know, the recent decisions on Syria that could be destabilizing and that allow Russia and Turkey to in some ways have the upper hand there. Yeah. So when you hear the president thanking Russia, and then you have Russia saying, well, we didn't know all about it. We don't know if we believe these American accounts, which, of course, is typical Russia. But then you have the president in the next breath criticizing Adam Schiff, who you could argue should have known about this ahead of time. You have to say there's difficulty in absorbing this without the politics surrounding it.
Well, Lisa, I'm going to give you a chance to respond when we come back from a break. But Natasha, I just want to hear briefly from you again. Your thoughts on what Michelle said?
Yeah, I just want to echo what Michelle said. Our sources are telling us as well that this operation had been in the planning stages since this summer, and that Baghdadi's location had been pretty much pinpointed, and there were multiple attempts to do this, but that were ultimately, you know, scrapped at the last minute. And then when Trump decided to pull out of Syria, there was obviously more urgency to get this done. So I would definitely echo what Michelle said in that this operation largely happened in spite of Trump's policies rather than because of them.
Well, Natasha Bertrand, Michelle Kaczynski, and Lisa Desjardins, stand by for just a second. We are looking at what happened over the weekend, and we will also look ahead to what is sure to be another big week in the news. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're taking a look at what's certain to be another big week in the news. And I'm joined today by Michelle Kaczynski. For years, she served as foreign correspondent for CNN, most recently as senior diplomatic correspondent. Natasha Bertrand joins us. She's national security correspondent for Politico. And Lisa Desjardins is with us as well. She covers the Capitol for PBS NewsHour. And Lisa, I wanted to give you just a chance to respond to what Michelle and Natasha were saying before the break about sort of how we're taking a look at this moment regarding the death of al-Baghdadi.
Yeah, sure. I actually think all three of us agree. I'm not, of course, saying, I think Michelle said something, and it's a right point. If you're going to focus only on the success of this mission, then you're missing so many things we need to question. And I agree. I'm not saying we should only focus on the success of the mission. I was just raising it. I thought it was important to note that this was a success. And, of course, there are many questions, and that's why I spoke about the problems in that area and the fact that the decisions the president is making, including removing U.S. troops, and the way he's working with Russia and Turkey have great consequences. And those are something, as Natasha and Michelle have mentioned, that are a huge concern for Republicans and Democrats at the Capitol and will continue to be.
Right.
I just wanted to make sure that, as Michelle is saying, let's cover it all. And I think we all agree.
Well, one thing that I keep coming back to, and I'm just going to do it right here, is that yes, it is just a military success, but we have seen similar successes regarding similar groups. I mean, the killing of Osama bin Laden was also a major success, but as we saw, that didn't necessarily lead to the end per se of Al Qaeda. It led to the splintering of an ideology that gave rise to ISIS. So, I mean, when fundamentally what is a battle here is a battle against a very virulent ideology, what I wonder, and Natasha, I'll turn to you on this, is, okay, we can look at the specifics around this particular military action here, but in the bigger picture of what it's going to take diplomatically, with allies around the world, with allies in the region, are we doing enough to undermine the very ideology that gives rise to groups like ISIS?
Sure. I mean, I think that, experts would argue that the Trump administration is doing quite the opposite at this point, especially by withdrawing all of the U.S. troops from Syria. But now that's kind of been walked back, obviously, with the president saying that there will remain a few troops there in order to protect the oil. But what he's doing in saying that even is projecting an image of the United States that for decades diplomats have been trying to undo in the psyche of the Middle East and the world, that the United States is only, launching these incursions into the Middle East because they want the oil. So on top of withdrawing troops from Syria and kind of leaving the country to a Russian and Turkish and Iranian sphere of influence, the president now is also turning to this new talking point where the United States is seen as just being in the Middle East because we want their oil.
Well, on that note, let's listen to exactly what the president said at the press conference yesterday when he said U.S. forces would remain in the area to secure those oil reserves, and he talked about why he believes this is an important goal.
It fueled ISIS, number one. Number two, it helps the Kurds because it's basically been taken away from the Kurds. They were able to live with that oil. And number three, it can help us because we should be able to take some also. And what I intend to do, perhaps, is make a deal with an ExxonMobil or one of our great companies to go in there and do it properly. Right now, it's not big. It's big oil underground, but it's not big oil up top. Much of the machinery has been shot and dead. It's been through wars.
Michelle, your thoughts?
Boy, every time I hear the way he describes, quote, taking the oil, not putting it aside, putting it into an escrow account, let's use it to help rebuild Syria later, the country's been destroyed. No, it's just taking the oil. And he's described this many times. And people who have covered the Middle East, diplomats who've been there for years, they bristle and they hurt to hear this description because it just further erodes the view and the influence of the United States in the Middle East. And many people feel that as the U.S. pulls away and, uses this kind of rhetoric, it's Russia that's quietly digging in and able to talk to all sides. They're against the kinds of sanctions that the U.S. uses throughout the region and that the U.S. continues to use and uses more and more to try to get other countries to do what it wants to do. But, others are stepping in to what many feel is a U.S. vacuum there. And, when you talk about what happens down the road for these terrorist groups. Nobody really knows what the next iteration of ISIS is going to be. And there's even some fear when we see al-Baghdadi captured in a place where many didn't expect him to be, in Idlib in the west, not along the border areas, not along the Euphrates, where ISIS had some of its last territory. There's a big question mark around there. Is Baghdadi and what remains of his team starting to work with splintered elements of al-Qaeda? Are they possibly going to work together for the next phase of what ISIS becomes? And that's worrisome. And the less influence that the U.S. has in the region, the more a danger it is to U.S. security,
right,
even at home. Because remember, people here are inspired by this ideology. So when the president talks about taking the oil, people who really care about the future of the region just shake their heads at best.
I mean, it just gets me back to thinking about the potential lost leverage that a moment like this presents, because, I mean, I think, Michelle, you mentioned it earlier, but I just want to underscore, by far, most of the victims of ISIS were Muslims.
So, Muslim.
Yes, good point. But so the idea that this could be a moment to further reach out and support Muslim allies in the region seems incredibly important to me. But let's turn to our listeners here. Let's go to Anna, who's calling from Parrish, Florida. Anna, you're on the air.
Hello, I'm all with the president of not telling the Democrats what was happening, because I don't trust them anymore. They do leak all the time. Nancy Pelosi is just should be sued for libel, as far as I'm concerned. I honestly believe they better get behind him a little bit, you know? And it's just like when they arrested El Chapo and he's at Supermax, it didn't change the drug war a whole lot. I'm sure at Baghdadi's death will be similar. However, we are owed some of that oil. Why not take some of it, U.S.? Come on. Be a little patriotic. I think you guys are not on the right side.
Well,
Democrats are damn ninnies, and that's all there is to it anymore.
Anna, just you got made 2 points there, and I'll ask Lisa Desjardins to respond to the, one of them. But about taking the oil, you can't just go to another country and take their natural resources. I mean, that's contravening international law. I mean, do you not agree with that?
No, they owe us already. You know, as far as Syria goes, anything to hurt them. Are you kidding? Remember, Assad, we don't like him, right? Yeah, get the oil.
All right, Anna. Yep, thank you for your call.
Well,
Lisa, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this sort of gets into a political realm in a way, because this is something that President Trump has tapped into with his supporters. And it is really important to look at how Americans see their place in the world right now. And if Americans feel that they are justified to take other people's oil, as Anna did, then that is something notable. And that's something the president is encouraging. But obviously, that is something that down the road could create more conflict. You know, I think that we've heard this notion of taking oil. It goes back to George W. Bush, of course, with Iraq, and that's how they were going to pay for the Iraq War, and it was all going to make sense. But you know, we've never actually seen it's only theoretical. Michelle can speak to this more, but it seems to me to be maybe more of a political statement when a leader says that than an actual plausible strategy in a region.
And
for that reason, I think it's concerning.
Go ahead, Michelle.
Yeah. It gets people fired up, and it's absolutely understandable why people see the mess over there and they see U.S. involvement and the confusion at times over what the U.S. should be doing. There's been so much argument over Syria since the Obama days and over ISIS as well. You know, what should the U.S.'s involvement be? So when you see the outcome, I get it that people say, we've paid for this. We've paid for this in lives as well. Why not? Why shouldn't we have a part of this? But step back a little bit, aside from the emotions surrounding this, and I think people should say, you know, the U.S. wants other countries, especially in regions where there is so much tension and conflict, they want other people to follow rules, because that means stability. That means that you get something for yourself if you follow the rules. So if the U.S. is going to contravene all legality, go into another country and take the oil out, you know, the U.S. doesn't just go into other countries generally unless there's a hugely overarching U.S. security threat, or if a ruling party in another country asks the U.S. to intervene. So if you're going to go in and take something, what's to stop any other country from going into some other country and taking something? The U.S. tries to establish and enforce international rules, so you don't want to break those rules yourself. You want to have as much order as possible.
Yeah. Going into countries and just taking their things sounds a lot like colonialism to me. But let's switch gears entirely here, because we've got a lot more to talk about regarding the week's news as it's going to unfold in front of us here for the remainder of this week. And Natasha, let me turn to you, because we've got some pretty important people who were lined up to be testifying or providing depositions in the House impeachment inquiry. But I'm seeing here that former Deputy National Security Advisor Charles Kupperman is a no-show for his testimony today, because he's actually asked for a court to intervene to decide what he's supposed to do here. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so this is a very important witness, obviously, for the Democrats. He was the top advisor to John Bolton, the former national security advisor, and he was present for a lot of the conversations, obviously, that had to do with Ukraine policy and the quid pro quo that took place, you know, regarding Trump's pressure on Ukraine in order to get them to launch political investigations into Joe Biden and interference in the 2016 election. What he did on Friday was he asked a court to rule, essentially, on whose subpoena and whose order he is obligated to listen to. Is he required to abide by the White House's order that he not testify, or is the congressional subpoena a stronger kind of legal basis and is something that he has to abide by? So, obviously, he is still waiting for the court to decide that, and what the court decides is obviously going to have a lot of impact on other witnesses. For example, John Bolton. If the court says that the congressional subpoena is really, you know, is weaker than the White House's desire to protect executive privilege, et cetera, then that might give John Bolton a reason not to testify. But of course, as we've seen, John Bolton seems actually to want to testify before Congress, and his lawyer has been in negotiations with the committees on that testimony.
Wow. Okay. So, Lisa, your thoughts on that? And also looking forward, I think I'm seeing here that by Thursday or on Thursday, we are expecting, I mean, who knows? Thursday is 5,000 news cycles from now. But Tim Morrison, the National Security Council Senior Director for Europe and Russia, is also on the list of people to provide testimony.
Yes. And so I guess to button up Kupperman, it's going to be so fascinating. And if anyone wants to read the court filings there, they're so interesting, where he lays out where he feels he's legally compelled both to follow the president's order and the order of Congress. And he says to a court, I cannot do both. And it's a
like
fascinating
putty
read
between the two.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was really fascinating to read. Now, as for Mr. Morrison, he is a much anticipated witness, perhaps one of the most anticipated witnesses of the week, because he works for the National Security Council. And part of the allegations here is that the president was operating essentially a backdoor diplomacy and going around professional American diplomats and using his own political kind of ally and personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, to conduct foreign policy. Tim Morrison with the National Security Council, the question is whether he will back up the testimony of other longtime sort of diplomatic and security professionals in saying that, yes, they were looped out and they believe there was a quid pro quo where the president was trying to get an investigation or a couple of investigations in return for several things that Ukraine wanted. So he's interesting to watch. And, you know, his attorney has said that he does plan to testify if subpoenaed. The Democrats have said they've shown they're willing to subpoena anyone. They often do it the morning of that testimony. So right now, the expectation is that he will appear all of this is happening. Meanwhile, as Democrats are getting what they believe is tremendous good news from the courts on Friday, a U.S. district court ruled essentially that their impeachment probe is effectively it is the equivalent of a judicial proceeding. Mm-hmm. And they ordered that the Justice Department hand over redacted materials that the Justice Department said that Congress had no right to read in a blistering 75-page, really well-documented decision. The judge really says that the House is right. This impeachment proceeding has more bearing and has more kind of consequence in the judicial system and does deserve to get these grand jury materials. Democrats see that as something, as we were just talking about, that they believe they will win more of these court battles when it comes to subpoenas as well. Remains to be seen. But so far, Democrats are winning in court when it comes to these process battles that could be very important down the road.
Well, Michelle, we've just got about a minute before we have to take a quick break here. But your thoughts on Tim Morrison's expected testimony, because in listening to Lisa, just reminded me of what the U.S. Charge d'Affaires William Taylor said in that opening statement of his about the informal policy that was being that he said was the informal diplomatic channels, as he called it, that was operating Ukraine against longstanding U.S. policy.
Yes. And Ukraine is such an important U.S. ally. So this big question of what was going on over there? Who was running policy? The people who, by law and according to their job description, are supposed to be doing it? Or is it the president's attorney, his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, who is running policy? That's what Democrats and many Republicans, by the way, too, want to get at. So the White House has tried to paint Bill Taylor, the former or the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine, as, just talking about hearsay, that he didn't really know what was going on. So Democrats are going to want as much backup of Bill Taylor's testimony as they can possibly get out of the next round of people to testify.
Well, Michelle Kaczynski, Natasha Bertrand, and Lisa Desjardins, hang on here for just a second. We are taking a quick break. And when we come back, we'll take a look at whether there are some fault lines emerging within the GOP over their support for the president. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Xinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what's to come in what's sure to be another big week in the news. And let's listen to what the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Democrat Adam Schiff, has to say about what's to come. He was on ABC's This Week yesterday, speaking with Martha Raddatz.
We will be doing public hearings, and I think we'll be doing them soon.
In a couple of weeks before Thanksgiving?
You know, I don't want to give precise timing because, in part, we're struggling with the White House's continuing efforts to obstruct our investigation, to obstruct witnesses coming in. My guess is they're going to fight us having John Bolton in, for example.
It's Congressman Adam Schiff on ABC's This Week. Over on CBS with Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation, former South Carolina Congressman Trey Gowdy shared his thoughts on the quid pro quo that's at the heart of this impeachment inquiry.
Well, you know, that means something for something. I need to know what both of those somethings is. If the something is we're not going to give you aid until you help us figure out who tried to interfere with the levers of democracy in 2016, Margaret, I can tell you if a Democrat did that, we'd be adding something to Mount Rushmore. I mean, we spent 2 years as a country trying to figure out who tried to interfere with our election. So clearly it can't be an impeachable offense.
That's former South Carolina Congressman Trey Gowdy on CBS just yesterday. Let's go to Gary, who's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Gary, you're on the air.
Hey, I've got a couple or two things I want to hit at real quick. One is that I don't know if you've heard, but in recent headlines, there was a juror who overslept and they got sent to jail. And then we've got professional lawyers and congressmen and the White House basically blocking people with a Congress-issued subpoena, and nothing's happening. What are y'all's thoughts on that, and is that a complete breakdown of our system?
And Gary, help me out here. The juror you're talking about regarding what case? I'm not sure about the...
It was on headlines, I believe, on CNN or one of the other major networks, but the poor guy got 10 days in jail because he overslept and missed, and he was a juror.
Oh, so you're saying that's the punishment for oversleeping versus what we're seeing when people don't show up to testify.
I gotcha.
Okay. So disparate approach.
Normal individual. Yeah.
Okay.
This is crazy.
Okay. Gary, thank you so much for your call. So Lisa, I mean, do you have a response for him about why there hasn't been more pushback against people not coming to testify?
Well, you know, there's a very complicated dynamic here with the Intelligence Committee. There are a couple. One is that the Intelligence Committees, their power to enforce these subpoenas is a little bit different than other committees. So when they do it, it's more complicated. It's not as easy for them to go straight to contempt as it may be for the House Oversight and other committees. But it's nuanced. It's complex. But I think the bigger point that when Democrats see these subpoenas being rejected, subpoenas being refused. Rudy Giuliani is someone who's recently refused a subpoena from these three committees, including intelligence. They are building a case for obstruction of justice. Each one of those refusals adds to a stack that they see as another possible impeachable offense by this president. And so they see something different than just their inability to get information, which I do believe Democrats honestly would like the information first and foremost. But next after that, they do think there's a case for obstruction here each time their subpoenas are not complied with. And that is the case that they're building. I think there's also one other thing I want to mention, though, is what's going on in foreign policy with all of this and with Ukraine. Natasha had a fantastic article over the weekend about the difficulty and questions that all of this raises for America in that region.
Right. And so, Natasha, Lisa, what an elegant handoff. Thank you for that. But Natasha, do you want to pick up on that? Because it does seem as if our Ukraine policy is kind of falling apart.
Yeah, thanks, Lisa. So what we were reporting, we wanted to find out how the impeachment process and how the president's pressure on the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has impacted U.S. policy toward Ukraine in the last couple months. And what we found is that, you know, the Ukrainians aren't really sure who they can trust in Washington anymore, because the interlocutors that they were dealing with, you know, people like Marie Yovanovitch, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, people like Kurt Volker, who, despite his involvement in all of this, was a very trusted figure by the Ukrainians, they're gone. And, you know, people like Bill Taylor, who remain in Kiev, who's now the acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, are weakened, and they're kind of distracted, frankly, because they're having to hire lawyers and they're having to deal with Democrats and the impeachment inquiry. And so, and you know, needless to say, the administration doesn't seem particularly interested in normalizing policy towards Ukraine at this point. So the Ukrainians are kind of struggling to figure out who the point person is in the administration that they can talk to about their problems. And they're also worried that, you know, the money that's been allocated to help them in the next year, the of military assistance aid that was, you know, allocated, appropriated by Congress and signed into law by Trump last month, they're really worried that that's actually, you know, going to hit a hitch sometime in the next year just because of the experience they went through in the last couple months. So there is a vacuum right now in policy, in, you know, who's in leadership on Ukraine policy, and the administration wasn't able to answer very basic questions that we posed to them about who is in charge now.
So, Michelle, let me turn to you here, because ought we not look at moments in moments like this to, I mean, conventionally, people like the Secretary of State for some form of leadership?
You would think, right? And people have been hurt within the State Department, for example, that Secretary of State Pompeo did not stand up for Marie Yovanovitch during this. One of the witnesses, I think it was Bill Taylor, described silence on the part of Secretary Pompeo. And now, when you the secretary was recently in Kansas again, and that's something that draws more criticism of him because people think that he's probably campaigning for an eventual Senate run. So aside from that, he goes to Kansas, as he does often. He does a wide-ranging round of interviews with local press. And, of course, they want to ask him about the news of the day and these extremely serious topics like who's running things, who's doing the work of the State Department, if not State Department people, are they qualified to do so? What are their interests? I mean, is our government working as it should be, basically? This is on the minds of not just people in Washington, but of course people in Kansas as well. And when the secretary gets questions like this, what does he say? Well, that question is insane. Or, you seem strangely obsessed with this subject. Or, I'm not going to talk about that today. I'm here to talk about workforce development. So you get these angry, frustrating answers from the Secretary of State. And you could see why he doesn't want to talk about these things and why he doesn't obviously want to be pulled between maybe what he himself thinks about things and what the president wants him to say. But he gives these answers that are not just leaving a lot to be desired. Yeah. They just make people angry.
I mean, I'm thinking of this Kansas City Star editorial that was written in response to the secretary's visits to Kansas. As you're right, referring, Michelle, I mean, the editorial was searing. I mean, they said, hey, guess what? Kansans care about what the Secretary of State does as well. And then they went on to say, I just have to read a little section of this because, you know, bravo to local newspapers for standing up for their communities. But the editorial says, quote, if Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is running to replace retiring U.S. Senator Pat Roberts, Republican of Kansas, then he should quit his rather important day job and do that. Or if, as he told the Star and the Wichita Eagle in a testy, credulity-straining interview on Thursday, yes, he isn't even thinking about it, then he should by all means focus on U.S. diplomacy. Remember diplomacy and stop hanging out here, meaning Kansas, every chance he gets. Now, that's from the Kansas City Star. Lisa Desjardins, let me turn back to you here about something, because, you know, I'm wondering, the Washington Post also recently wrote a story about sort of, I don't know if fault lines is the right term to use here, but sort of concerns that differ from House GOP members versus Senate GOP members. Someone, an unnamed senator, was calling it rather like a horror movie. I mean, is that overstating yes, the differences between the two chambers right now?
No. It's a very clear split. Now, I will say there are also ardent Republican supporters of the president in the Senate, but the ratio is way different. In the House, there's kind of a fever pitch for the president. And in fact, when you talk about the move by House members last week to sort of march into this secure facility where most of them were not supposed to be with their phones, which all of them know they were not supposed to bring, and to stay there and to order pizza and make it sort of a circus when there are obviously serious depositions happening or were about to happen.
Some of them could attend, by the way.
More than two dozen of them were able to attend them just by walking in. But instead, they staged a protest. You know, and I talked to House Republicans about that and said, you know, what's your calculation on this exactly? You risk looking like kind of kids, you know, and they told me, no, we feel like our base, it's not just that the president controls our message, he is the message. And we feel like we cannot do enough to fight for him. Also, the president has told us he wants us to do things like this. He wants us to do things that make news fighting for him. We don't think we lose on this. They all know there's a risk. But then the House, the Senate side, to them, it was sort of unimaginable, this idea of storming into a secure facility. It is something that concerns Republican senators, makes them think that there is a loss of conversation, serious thought. It worries them about governing, but it also worries them because it puts more political pressure on those Republicans to stay in line and not criticize the president, even when they believe he deserves it on important policy matters. That split is right now most prominent when it comes to our policy in Turkey and with Turkey and Syria. And I think that that is an area where the president really has a problem, even though he's ostensibly, you hear Republicans praising him the last few days. There still is a deep underlying concern and even mistrust about how the president's handling that from Republicans.
Wow. And since you mentioned sort of the U.S. policy on Syria here, I'm seeing that today the U.N. Special Envoy for Syria is saying that he'll meet with foreign ministers from Turkey, Iran and Russia in Geneva tomorrow, a day ahead of the first meeting of Syria's Constitutional Committee, not mentioning the U.S. there. I want to make a little bit of time to get at least one more caller in here. So let's go to Jim, who's calling from Waterloo, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the impeachment inquiry. As far as I understand, the only thing that's been released regarding that phone call is a memo of the transcript. Will the actual transcript, has it been released? Will it be released to Congress? Will it be publicly released? Like the full transcript, the one that was allegedly saved to the super duper double dot secret server.
Mm-hmm.
Will we ever see the actual transcript, or are we just dealing with the memo?
All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much for your call. Natasha, do you have any insight for Jim?
Yeah, it's a great question. We actually don't know at this point, I don't think, whether there actually is a word-for-word official transcript. This memo, this record of the call may be all that there is. And this memo is something that was placed in that top secret NSC code word system. And sometimes we're told there isn't an actual word for word transcript taken. These kinds of memos are all that are recorded by NSC staff. So we haven't gotten a straight answer from the administration on whether there is an official transcript. The president has alluded in the past in public remarks that there might be one. But, you know, if anyone's going to get that, it probably won't be the Democrats launching the impeachment inquiry.
Okay. Well, we've just got a couple of minutes left here, and I want to just touch down briefly on some other news from around the world, try to cram it in here. Michelle, just got to turn to
you.
Right,
there is other news around.
Things are messed up here. There's always Brexit to compare ourselves to. Another extension
the way in
there.
In the beginning, you said, well, we'll always have Brexit.
We will, apparently.
So, yeah, well, there's been movement. Now, at least the EU has accepted the UK's request to extend the Brexit deadline to the end of January. And there was this kind of standoff because I should preface this by saying Brexit is the most complicated thing. You have to listen hourly to really know what's going on with Brexit, right? Most Americans, I don't know how they keep up. You really have to know the ins and outs of British politics. It's confusing for Americans to pay attention to. But
most
in a nutshell,
Brits are confused too, to be honest.
I know. It's an ongoing soap opera, but there was this kind of standoff because the UK wanted first to make sure that the EU was going to accept an extension before it moved to an election. And the EU wanted to make sure that the UK had its ducks in a row. So now the EU has said, OK, you can have another extension. It's going to be January 31st for the Brexit deadline. And now what remains is to see if the UK really does have another election. This could help Boris Johnson it could help him solidify what he lacks right now, which is a majority in Parliament. Labor, the opposition, has been now trying to put off having an election. So we don't know where that's going to go. If there is an election, which probably there will be, it could be the closest thing. I mean, this could be on a razor's edge. Because you have interesting scenarios in parts of Britain where you have long-time working-class towns where all, say, the coal mining has left. Mm. Those are hardcore Labour voters. They do not want to vote for Conservatives, but they also want to leave the EU. So what do you do in that situation? Do you suck it up and vote for a Conservative when your dad and your dad's dad and your mom's mom and for generations has refused to vote Conservative? Do you do that so that you have a better chance of really leaving the EU because you don't see any benefits of globalism going to your town? These are the kinds of things that people are struggling with, not only in these towns in the UK, but in different kinds of towns all over the world.
Exactly. Well, Michelle Kaczynski, for years she served as foreign correspondent for CNN, most recently as senior diplomatic correspondent. Michelle, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you.
You too. Thanks, everyone.
And Natasha Bertrand, national security correspondent for Politico. Thank you so much for being with us, Natasha.
Thanks for having me.
And Lisa Desjardins, who covers the U.S. Capitol for PBS NewsHour. Lisa, it's always wonderful to have you. Thank you.
Great job, Meghna. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.